It's 6 after 9. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this morning on the Ideas Network of WPR. We're going to tackle a couple of online-related topics this morning, starting with worldwide calls for the regulation of alcohol advertising in social media. Are alcohol manufacturers targeting young people? And what are the effects of all this online alcohol marketing? Later on, we'll talk about Facebook's new privacy policy. What's changed? What do we still need to watch out for? And what are some of the concerns we should have about online privacy for our youth? Those issues will be what we talk about this hour. And as usual, we have found an expert to help us sort these out. My guest this hour is Catherine Montgomery, professor of communication at American University in Washington, D.C., and co-author of the report Alcohol Marketing in the Digital Age. She also testified before a congressional committee on the issue of online privacy for children this April and has written extensively on the subject of children's online privacy. Good morning, Professor, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, and thanks very much.
Well, we'll start with the alcohol advertising online. We're all used to seeing beer ads and other adult beverages advertised on television. We hear them on the radio. That's been true for years. So what's changed in the last few years about alcohol advertising, and what's different about their online approach?
Well, what has changed is that the nature of advertising has changed with the introduction and growth of the Internet. And it's part of what the advertising industry calls a digital marketing ecosystem. It's very different from traditional advertising as we know it. We're now talking about a 24/7 marketing culture that is able to reach people anywhere they are, any time of the day, 24/7. That includes mobile phones, and increasingly kids are using their mobile phones 24/7. If you have any kids, you understand how that works. They wake up with them and they go to bed with them. It's also a marketing system that targets individuals through behavioral profiling, and we haven't had that in the past. And it is one that creates immersive environments, from virtual worlds, and we've seen a lot of that with the alcohol marketing, to in-game advertising and a whole range of other strategies that are quite different from what we have traditionally understood to be advertising.
So let's talk about some examples of this. You co-authored the study Alcohol Marketing in the Digital Age, and one of the very first things in the report is a description of something that Heineken was doing. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Right. So this is an example of the combination of online and offline strategies. And in the case of Heineken, they created a virtual world, a real kind of community. And when you first heard about it, it looked like you were being introduced to a real world community, but in fact it's an online community. And it's one in which you participate in all kinds of activities online and engage with a world of a Heineken world in many ways. It's a good example of the engaging qualities of digital marketing, that it's not just about getting an ad, you know, having an ad beamed at you in the middle of a television program. It is interacting with the product, interacting with the brand in ways that ties your whole identity into the brand marketing and the brand experience. It's very experiential.
So obviously there's a strategy behind this. Is this working for them? I mean, do we have any measures about how effective this type of advertising has been at getting people to consume more alcohol?
Well, what we know is that the online advertising industry, and this really covers a whole wide range of products, and I've done a lot of research also on food marketing and the digital media. The online advertising industry is doing extensive research to perfect the techniques and to ensure that they work. And in fact, they have incorporated measurement into the advertising itself and developed very, very detailed ways of testing the impact of the marketing. They are honing all of this, and they're experimenting with a lot of different strategies in ways that are really having an effect. Now, a lot of that research specifically is proprietary, and one of the things that we call for is for the Federal Trade Commission to do the kind of investigation of alcohol marketing and the research involved in alcohol marketing in digital media that they have been required to do with food marketing.
The World Health Organization is very concerned about the worldwide consumption of alcohol. They're calling for action pretty much everywhere. And I'll give you an example of what's happening elsewhere. In Europe, online sites have been used to organize massive binge drinking festivals. Are we seeing anything like this happening in the United States?
Well, what we're seeing is the proliferation of a lot of alcohol marketing on a lot of different platforms, and social network platforms are a very important venue, so that what we're seeing is a kind of encouragement of the sort of culture of binge drinking. You can send a coupon to a friend for a free drink. With mobile marketing, it can tap you wherever you are and encourage drinking. And I think the important thing here is that young people are living their lives online, particularly adolescents. This is a medium, and particularly with social networks, that encourages them and enables them to explore their identities, to reach out to peers, to really to begin operating in the world outside of the purview of their parents in a lot of ways. And in many ways, it's very good. But the problem is that all of this is happening under the radar of many parents. So, we as parents aren't totally aware of what's going on. And certainly it needs to be investigated. And if you look at the ways in which alcohol products are promoted, and think about the socialization effects of new media, combined with everything else kids are experiencing in the culture, there is a real concern. There is a crisis in terms of binge drinking. It's a killer. Kids are dying from it. I work on a college campus, and every week or so, an ambulance shows up to take someone to the hospital because of an overdose of alcohol. So these are serious problems.
Well, and it's been an issue for a long time. I was on the faculty at the University of Minnesota Duluth for a number of years in the 80s, and I remember students joking about going down to sell plasma so they could go to Long Island Tea Night at a local saloon. It's kids and drinking. There's something there. The WHO says that harmful drinking is the third leading risk factor for disability and premature death in the world. We're talking about 2.5 million deaths each year linked to alcohol worldwide, and a lot of those are people between the ages of 15 and 29. 15, wow.
Yeah, and, high schools are confronting this problem. I mean, kids are bringing drinks to high schools, in the U.S. at least, in, soda pop bottles, in water bottles, finding all kinds of ways to get involved in drinking. The other thing that's really interesting is that there is new research, relatively recent research, on adolescence as a period of development. And scholars are learning that the brain in adolescence doesn't fully develop, that it's really not fully developed until adulthood in the 20s. And the part of the brain that really involves judgment and choice and responsibility, this executive functioning part of the brain, is not completely developed. And at the same time, the impulsive part of the brain is very strong. And, we all know, if any of us have, we've all been teenagers, and we know that the experience of being an adolescent is such that impulsive behaviors are very common and peer influences are common. So in many ways, we have a kind of perfect storm that has been created that sets kids up for very dangerous behaviors. It's not new. I mean, we've had this problem for a long time, and you can't put all the blame on digital marketing. But what I think is important is that we understand what is different about it, how it works, and it gets included in the debates about interventions, about public health interventions for young people.
One of the, well, I want to give the phone number because we need to invite callers to join this discussion. I would imagine that a lot of people are going to be really interested in this. My imagination has been wrong before. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program. What do you think about this? Have you noticed online alcohol advertising? What do you think about it? Is this a case of, well, you know, we advertise a lot of things. Why should that be any different? People still need to exercise their own will and their own discretion about the products they buy. Should we be putting some limits on this? Should there be some rules about how online advertising works and who needs to impose those rules? Or do we need to let the free market work its own thing? Let us know what you think. 800-642-1234. You can also reach us via email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. You can also find us on Facebook. Look for Kathleen Dunn on Facebook, and you can leave a comment there, and we'll share it with the radio audience. My guest this morning is Catherine Montgomery, communication professor at American University and co-author of the report Alcohol in the Marketing Age. We're going to be talking about Facebook's privacy policy a little bit later on this hour. So if you've got a call or a question related to that, hold it. And when we kind of make a shift to that topic, which is directly related to what we're talking about now, we'll take those comments and questions then. Professor, one of the things that I read in your report, and I want you to talk about this and how effective it might be. We mentioned Heineken's virtual world that they've created. Heineken subscribes to a self-regulatory code of ethics that includes provisions for limiting exposure to marketing messages by underage youth. Is that a fig leaf, or is there really something there?
Well, I think this is an area that the government needs to look into more closely, because when it comes to online marketing, you've got to have some mechanisms that will really work. If you're talking about advertising in a magazine or on television, it is somewhat easier to create some restrictions in terms of where ads appear, but online is a little bit more challenging. I actually did a report with an organization I ran in the 90s that looked at alcohol marketing on the web way back in 1997. Ours was the first report to begin examining all of the ways that marketing was taking place and the ways that advertisers for alcohol products were using it. And they were very, very appealing to youth at that time. One of the outcomes of that report was, and the government response to it, was self-regulatory codes that ask for a person's age, where you have to input the birth date. And I remember at the time thinking, well, that's a joke. And, it still remains a bit of a big problem. We don't know how well these things work. If you enter a birth date, I mean, any kid who can do any math could enter a birth date that would make that person look as if they were 21. And that is just not going to work. At the same time, I think we have to be careful that we're not creating some privacy problems by calling for some kind of ID. I mean, this isn't a naughty problem. It's a difficult problem. And it's one that we're going to need the government to work hand in hand with industry to solve. But the problem has been that, for the most part, the marketing has continued unabated with some regulatory codes that may sound good but are not necessarily as effective as they should be.
We're talking about online marketing and data collection and privacy and all of that stuff this hour. Right now, we're talking about alcohol marketing online and what should be done, what might be done, what might work, what's being done or not being done right now. And we invite you to join our discussion. We have some calls coming in, and we'll get to those in just a moment. Still have a space for you in the queue if you call right now, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email address, talk@WPR.org, and also you can look for Kathleen Dunn on Facebook and leave a message there, and we'll share that or the question with our radio audience. We'll convert digital to analog and then back to digital again. It's complicated. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 22 minutes after 9 o'clock. Coming up later this morning, President Obama will release the White House's 30-day safety review of deepwater drilling and take questions about the Gulf oil spill and his administration's response to the disaster. NPR's Neil Conan will host the event and will be joined by Ron Elving, senior Washington editor, and Elizabeth Shogren, environmental correspondent. We expect this special to begin at 11:45 and end around 1 o'clock. Listeners to Chapter a Day can hear the program this evening at 11 o'clock or online at WPR.org/chapter. So that's coming up later this morning, special coverage of the president's remarks about the Gulf oil spill. This hour, we're talking about online alcohol advertising as one online topic. And then later on in the hour, we're going to talk about Facebook's new privacy policy and what it means. And also, how private can your children's activities be on the Internet? What do people find out about your kids online that you might not want them to know? We have a guest expert who can talk on both topics, which is always fortunate for us and for you as well. My guest this morning, Catherine Montgomery, communication professor at American University in Washington, D.C., and co-author of the report, Alcohol Marketing in the Digital Age. She's also done extensive work on our children's online activities and how to keep them safe when they're online. 800-642-1234, that's the phone number. Let's go to some calls. We'll start with Frank in Madison. Frank, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me. I hope I can be clear here. I want to stress how dangerous it is to develop a culture of drinking. There were two things I've seen. One is an op-ed piece in this past Sunday, May 23rd, New York Times. I believe Nicholas Kristof wrote it, in which he laments how a bunch of folks in Africa are just drinking up what little money they have, and then not having enough money to send their kids to school. And, of course, he blames it all on these guys' lack of moral fiber and all that. That sort of us versus them and how immoral they are not to have the moral strength to, you know, limit their drinking. But the other part is a book that I read recently, James Marone's Hellfire Nation, that basically traces American attitudes and how it is that we get things done politically. And there was an interesting fact in there that was very surprising to me, which was that after Prohibition was repealed, the level of drinking in America did not go up or did not return to the rather high levels it had been at that actually inspired Prohibition. And the point is that it isn't this moral strength of individuals, or rather that the moral strength of individuals is not a function purely of their own individual selves, but it's a function of the society, and that, frankly, the more people drink, the more people will start drinking, and the more the amount of drinking that people engage in depends on how many other people are drinking. And it doesn't matter whether they think that they are weak-willed people and are saying, oh, I just don't have the strength to do this or anything. This is a societal effect. And if we let these advertising companies start driving our society this way, we will suddenly find, not suddenly, we will just gradually slide into a status of a lot more alcoholism and a lot more just plain drinking and wasting of our effort along those lines. Anyway, I think I made my point.
Well, Frank, hang on. Before I have Professor Montgomery respond to your comments, do you have an idea of what we ought to do about it?
Kill Madison Avenue. It's advertising. The past 100 years has seen the perfection of advertising. I guess it all started in World War I when when whatever bunch it was that figured out how to sell World War I to the Americans simply passed from the wartime footing to selling things in the roaring 20s and further. It's advertising. Got it, I think.
All right, thanks, Frank.
It just builds a public attitude, and then people just start slipping into patterns. I think the fat or obesity is simply, you know, one of the obvious results of a subtle undermining of people's thought patterns by advertising that you know you might not even be aware of.
All right, Frank, thanks a lot for that, Professor.
Well, absolutely advertising plays a very important role, especially these days. It is part of the environment in which young people are growing up. And we can't kill Madison Avenue. Sometimes I get very mad at Madison Avenue. But what we do need is a system of self-regulation and government regulation that works. And that means we have to keep the pressure on these companies, and we have to engage consumers around some of these issues. And there may be a way to engage young people around some of them as well. In the tobacco field, where, you know, it took many, many, many years of efforts to get the tobacco industry through legal measures to change its marketing and the way it was influencing young people, we now are able to mobilize young people through the Truth Campaign to address, to engage with, to understand how marketing influences them, and to counter those efforts. And that is one thing that we may want to do in this area as well. We have to make it very conscious with young people. But, you know, it's this question of personal responsibility always comes up. It comes up also in discussions and debates about food marketing. Why can't you just say no? You know, it's the person who makes the decision. It's the parent who makes the decision about buying products. It's the kid who makes the decision and the teenager who makes the decision about what to do. And, yes, that's important. We do want to encourage personal responsibility, but it isn't either or. There has to be corporate responsibility as well. There has to be real industry responsibility. And that's what we don't see enough of here. And what unfortunately happens is that the marketers of alcohol and tobacco, and in this case alcohol specifically, find ways to circumvent the constraints that are put in place to limit the way they influence young people.
I
think, again, the use of social networks is one. The use of viral marketing, where, you know, campaigns are created and young people are encouraged to promote the product among themselves. This is not something you're going to see on a billboard. It's happening in ways that the adults may not know about. Or the use of viral videos on YouTube, or co-created marketing, which is another technique that we have documented in our work, where you encourage people, and particularly young people who love to make videos to promote the product. And there are lots of examples in our report. I also want to encourage people to go to the website digitalads.org, which not only includes our report, but many, many other examples of how digital marketing works.
Digitalads.org. I expect that website will appear as a link on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page and on WPR.org as well before the end of the day. But you heard it here, digitalads.org. Holly in Madison, you'll be next. Holly, good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to say that drinking has been around. I graduated in 1983. If this is a new thing, it's not. I do agree that, I mean, you can be any age you want to be on the internet, and I don't know how they're going to, have restrictions for that. But not only that, I mean, there are billboards I drive by every day that advertise alcohol. The Super Bowl usually has, you know, I mean, they think beer is just beer. Beer is alcohol. And in the state of Wisconsin, I've lived here my whole life. They need to really crack down on stuff, including drunk driving. I mean, in most states, if you get one drunk driving, you go to jail. And it just amazes me that not only the internet, but just all the advertising all over. And so I don't know how they can impose. I think it's a great idea to impose things, but all you usually have to do on the internet, even YouTube, is just click that, yes, you're over 18.
Well, that's certainly true, and this is a complex problem. There's no question about that, and it's a problem that has been going on for years. We haven't solved it yet, unfortunately. And I think there are ways, though, that we need to think about that the marketers know more precisely who they're targeting and who they're reaching. And so there are some ways, I think, that the industry could ensure that its advertising strategies are not reaching young people. One of the things that the World Health Organization called for was to reduce not just marketing to underage youth, and of course in Europe that's often under 18, but to youth in general, because youth, any advertising that's marketed to youth in general is going to be very appealing to teenagers who are more vulnerable to these kinds of things. But this problem, which is a very serious problem, is going to require multiple strategies. And we need to reverse the trends in ways that will make an impact in the lives of young people. Some of it needs to involve education. I think we could do a lot more to educate young people about how alcohol consumption affects them. And it's true that, you know, at some ages it doesn't sink in very well. We need better ways to do that. So there's a lot we need to do.
Well, let's take another phone call, and then I want to try to wrap up this aspect of the topic and then kind of shift into talking about online media and privacy, because of the big announcement from Facebook yesterday. We'll be moving to that here shortly. But first, let's hear what Ellen in Milwaukee has to say. Ellen, good morning.
Morning. One of the things that I always think of when I think about any kind of coercion into doing something against your better interest is the fact that we don't really educate from kindergarten on our citizenry to recognize and understand that advertising or anything coming at you to tell you to do something generally has been backed by psychologists and psychological studies on ways to get around your reason. And I don't think, in education very much anymore, we are raising people and teaching our students to think analytically, to think for themselves, you know, like a really good liberal arts kind of education. We're more like training people for jobs from the time they're in kindergarten. And one other thing I was thinking as you were talking is, if we could train children to think in terms of corporations' interest is to get them to be controlled by a corporation to do what the corporation wants, that I think that since people don't like to be controlled by others, that I think if we could instill that kind of an education and knowledge in people so that, you know, they would recognize that, oh, the cigarette companies, the people who sell designer clothes, whatever, are trying to control you to do what they want, as opposed to what you want to do. And they're very successful at it because they use the help of psychologists to figure out how to get around our brain.
Professor?
And actually, in the new marketing era, the techniques for appealing to the subconscious have gotten even more sophisticated with what's called neuromarketing, using the science, neuroscience, and the techniques of neuroscience to actually test how the brain responds to messages and to appeals that are emotional appeals, that are subconscious, unconscious appeals. Unconscious strategies have been going on forever, certainly in the 20th century, in marketing and advertising, but they have made it much more precise, and I do believe that education is going to be very important. One of the challenges, though, is that this digital environment is so engaging, and it taps into the developmental needs of adolescents so effectively that when you talk about needing to develop your identity and the brand experience gets tied into your identity, that's a hard thing to counteract. And the other thing is that we're talking about peers influencing each other, peers sharing brands, friends, and what Facebook calls the social graph, which is all of the different people that you know and interact with as a system for influence. That is very much the business model of contemporary marketing.
Well, okay, we've talked about how this is a problem and how this works against our youth and so forth. There are calls for the Federal Trade Commission and State Attorney General to do something about this. I guess the question that I have, given the ubiquitous nature of advertising and marketing messages, it permeates our culture, how... What role is there for the government? I mean, how could the Federal Trade Commission act in this area? Do we need some kind of regulation? And if so, what would be regulated? How can we solve this problem?
Well, let me first talk about what we have been able to do in the past, because I ran an organization in the 90s that led a campaign to do something about children's marketing and online privacy. And we were successful at getting a law passed in 1998 called the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA for short. And what we were able to do was to put in place some mechanisms, certainly for younger children, for under 13, whereby marketers could no longer do what they were trying to do, and that was to collect a lot of personal information from young kids. And we identified during that time websites being set up, like Young Investors, that was asking kids for, you know, all kinds of personal financial information. That was the direction that the web was going in at that time. And it hasn't stopped that direction, but what we were able to do in the case of kids was to create some mechanisms so that they cannot do that anymore. You can't collect personal information from a child under the age of 13. And we were able to do it because marketers are targeting specifically to an age group. A lot of people said, well, that's going to be really hard to do. But we did it. We did it by working with industry and with government. And it has been successful. The Federal Trade Commission is reviewing that rule and that law now. And there's consensus within the industry that they were able to operate within that framework. And I think we're looking now at what do we do about teenagers? What do we do about adolescents and the fact that they are on Facebook and other social networks, sharing everything they know and not really with any protections at all. And it will take a combination of efforts. I mean, Facebook has just changed its practices from an incredibly complicated set of things a person had to do to protect his or her privacy to a less complicated system. But that only happened because not only was there consumer backlash, but there was activism from the consumer community and the privacy community, and there was oversight from the government. You know, we had senators calling for Facebook to do something about it. So what we need to do is to create a framework that is a combination of some government oversight and industry self-regulation that will create some mechanisms to safeguard privacy.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break, and then you bring up the Facebook controversy. We're going to be talking about that for the rest of the hour. If you would like to get in on that subject, we will be kind of switching topics here and moving to discuss Facebook's new policy, the privacy announcement or the privacy policy announcement that was made yesterday by the CEO of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg. We'll be talking about that for the rest of the hour. And you can join us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also join us on Facebook. Well, there it is. Kathleen Dunn has a fan page on Facebook. You can leave a message there. We'll pass that along. And we will also take your emails at talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:41. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Here is a special program note for Ideas Network listeners. Later this morning, President Obama will release the White House 30-day safety review of deep water drilling. He'll also take questions about the Gulf oil spill and his administration's response to it. NPR's David Green will host the event and be joined by Ron Elving, senior Washington editor, and Elizabeth Shogren, environmental correspondent. This special will begin at 11:40 and end at 1 o'clock. Listeners to Chapter a Day can hear the program this evening at 11 p.m., or they can listen to it online at WPR.org/chapter. So we'll be carrying President Obama's remarks and the questions that he will take, an NPR special starting at 11:40 this morning here on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking right now we're talking about online privacy and what that really means in light of the hubbub, the furor, the controversy surrounding Facebook's privacy policy changes and the backlash against that, which prompted them to respond by changing their privacy policy, making it easier for people to keep their information on Facebook private, or at least limited to the people they want to have it. We're going to talk about that issue for the rest of this hour. And again, my guest is Catherine Montgomery, professor of communication at American University in Washington, D.C. She's co-author of the report Alcohol Marketing in the Digital Age, which we've talked about already this hour. But she also gave testimony before a congressional committee on this issue in April, and was one of the architects of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which was passed in the 90s. So she is the expert on this topic. So, Professor, this issue, Facebook's changes to its privacy policy, certainly one aspect of the whole online privacy debate. They reconsidered their policies. They issued new policies, announced them yesterday, or at least announced that they were making changes to make it easier for people to keep their online information to themselves, or at least to those people they want to share it with. But that issue is ongoing, and it's not just Facebook. There are a lot of social networking sites. They aren't as big as Facebook, but they're out there. MySpace is still around. You've got Twitter, and you know, dozens of other ways that people can share information. Yahoo is doing, if you have a Yahoo email account, you can give status updates and have contacts and connections and so forth. Gmail is doing the same thing. There are a lot of attempts to set up social networks. That's the kind of where a lot of people spend their lives, apparently, is online. So what are, let's start with this. What are my reasonable expectations for privacy in a social networking situation online?
Well, I think the problem is you shouldn't expect much privacy at the present time. You can now, with Facebook, make some changes that you have to do to ensure that what you put up there doesn't get out to the whole world. I still think they're pretty complicated, and I think we'll have to see how it rolls out, how effective they are. But I think people need to understand that in the online digital environment, privacy is very much threatened. We, as I mentioned earlier, we have some protections for children, only those who are under 13, but for the rest of us, for teenagers and for the rest of us, privacy is very much at risk. And there is a movement in the U.S. and abroad among the consumer and privacy community to promote some rules, government rules and industry rules that really will protect people's privacy. And part of the problem, it's not just the nature of the internet where everything's out there and it's public, and it's not even just the nature of social networks, which make it even more public by the ways that networks are constructed, but it's also the business model, which has really been around since the 90s, of what used to be called one-to-one marketing and has now evolved into behavioral targeting. Marketers in the digital environment are using information collected from a lot of different interactions that people engage in online to design marketing that's personalized and targeted to individuals. They are creating personal profiles based on where you go online, on the kinds of searches you do, on what you do on social networks. Drug companies are using this information, for example, to target drugs to you and to create a profile of you based on, you know, the fact that you might be looking for information about a symptom or a disease. And all of this is, at the present time, fair game. The Federal Trade Commission has been looking into what can be done about this. They've called on industry for self-regulation. There are some, you know, tentative proposals from some industry groups about how to safeguard consumer privacy, but much, much more will need to be done. And we're really seeing a kind of coalescence of factors in the EU and here in the U.S., where I think consumers are beginning to realize that we need some fair rules across the board.
Well, Marsha Hoffman with the Electronic Frontier Foundation in the New York Times says we need a social networking bill of rights. Is that what you're talking about?
That's a good start. Absolutely. A social networking bill of rights, when we talk about an expectation of privacy, that needs to be spelled out. And what we've seen, and this is also very interesting in terms of recent history, in the 1990s, when there was a lot of concern that many of us were raising about privacy in the early days of the dot-com boom and of e-commerce, the answer was for companies to come up with privacy policies. So, you know, now you see every website has a privacy policy. Well, they're written by lawyers. They don't make much sense to ordinary consumers. Often they say we have the right to do anything we want, or we're doing all of this for your benefit. And that really just hasn't worked. Consumers need to know exactly what's going on. They need to be communicated with more effectively, and they need to be able to have user-friendly controls so they can set the terms of what they share and what they don't share. And particularly, marketers need to, and companies who use online marketing, need to explain what they're doing, need to explain that they're using behavioral profiling, that they're tracking every move, that they're working with certain companies that can track where you're going on the internet with ad networks, for example. That needs to be spelled out and made clear to people.
Yeah, those privacy policies that you see online, they're usually in about a 3-point font, and I think they were not only written by lawyers, but they were translated rather badly from Sanskrit. They're very difficult
to read.
You
got it. They're very hard to read. I sometimes ask my students, the other thing is, you know, who wants to read them? I mean, we want to do things online, and you know, you just want to get past that stuff.
Yeah.
How many times have you gone online and it says, we have to click I agree here? Well, you don't even know what you're agreeing to. You'd have to stop everything to read that to figure it out. That can be done in a more user-friendly way. And right now what we see is, you know, accept our terms or forget about it.
Well, and there's an element of trust here. I mean, you
yes.
click on that because, you know, you think that the company you're dealing with isn't going to deliberately do something bad to you. But that's, you know, when maybe we're a little, I don't know, I hate to use the word gormless, but we're at least too trusting.
Well, and people don't really understand how all this works. We need to do a lot. That's a lot of what I do in the work that I do is try to explain to the public health community about how it works in the food marketing area and to experts on youth to have them understand how it works. You know, I teach undergraduates, and I sometimes ask them, you know, have you ever looked at the privacy policy on MySpace or Facebook? Well, no, you know, and what do you know about privacy? Well, they think they know certain things, but there's a lot they don't know about what goes on really behind the scenes.
Well, and I mean, I guess there's a certain element of caveat emptor here. You should never put anything in an electronic form that you don't want the whole world to know about.
Well, that's true, but what people don't understand is how your behavior is tracked. So if you're looking for something online, that is tracked. And you need these tools. They're wonderful tools, you know. So I want to go online and find out, you know, what it means that my knee hurts, or you know, let's do a little bit of research on that. If I do that at the library, do I have somebody following me around to see what books I open? No. Online, it's part of the way the system works.
I thought that was the FBI's job to follow you around the library and see what books you're in. Never mind. Don't send me any emails on that. It was another bad joke. I'm famous for them. Steve, who couldn't stay on the line with us, called in, but he was wondering about European privacy legislation and wants to know more about it and why we don't have similar laws here. Are privacy laws tougher over in Europe than they are in the United States?
Yes. And in the 1990s, in fact, the EU put a lot of pressure on the U.S. to comply with its privacy directives. They have a much broader, clearer set of privacy rules. And I was involved in all of it over here, and boy, I'm telling you, we couldn't get industry to move. It was hard to get government to move. They did move in certain areas. But meanwhile, the European Union states have set up, you know, the European Commission has a whole set of rules. They have privacy directives. They have a whole working group on this. And it's much stronger. And there's a cultural difference as well. There is an understanding of privacy as a right from the European framework. And we need to inculcate that notion here. We should raise our kids to believe that privacy is a right. And in this era, I think we're doing the opposite. We're basically socializing them into believing that, you know, privacy doesn't count for anything. And it, in fact, it is a very important right.
Let's try and get a couple of calls in here before the top of the hour. We'll go to Matthew in Eau Claire first. Matthew, good morning.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for taking my call. In the next couple of years, I expect to have a website up, and it'll have social aspects. And as an entrepreneur, I know that other people will be trying to influence me to give out the people who are on my website their information, to give up their personal information. So my question is, as a person who will be looking into something for a business model, how could I protect their personal information, and what type of privacy policy would I have to make them feel comfortable with my website?
Well, good question. Fortunately, you know, there are companies and organizations that have been set up to help create some self-regulatory codes. There's always more work that could be done in this area. But if you go to the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, FTC.gov, you will see a listing of organizations that have been set up to protect privacy and to help companies create some mechanisms for protecting privacy. We've done this with children's privacy, and to some extent you'll see it with adult privacy as well. This is a changing landscape, and so I think it will be important for businesses to be aware of how those rules might be changing. And I also think it's going to be important to have some clear rules of the game that create a level playing field for everybody. So here's what you do. We were able to do that with kids. You market to kids, you follow these rules. No problem.
Matthew, thanks for the call. Let's take a quick call from Rick in Stockton, Illinois. Rick, good morning.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I've been online for 15 years with email and websites and all that. And, you know, they basically have all my information already. I mean, really the cat's out of the bag. Even if there were these new privacy controls, they still have collected, you know, untold of amounts of information on all of us already that can't be undone.
And what about it? They've got our info. The horse is out of the barn, a little late to close the door now.
Well, you know, there are some things we could do. You could have said that, you know, 25 years ago about credit information, for example. And under the, you know, Fair Credit Reporting Act, we now have access to information about us that we didn't have access to. So we might be able to set up some mechanisms that will enable us to know what they have on us. Why shouldn't we be able to know? You know, how that's done, we'd have to work out the details. But we ought to be able to know what information is collected on us and how it's collected. It is something we were able to get into the children's privacy law.
Well, let's talk about children as we close the program here this morning. The mining of data, how is that affecting our children, and do we need to go back and take another look at the COPPA law and make it stronger, or do we just need to enforce it? What's enforcement like of this? What is the risk to our children here?
Well, COPPA was enacted in 1998, and it took effect in 2000. A lot's changed since then. Fortunately, the law included a provision that takes into account the changes that are taking place in the industry, and that's precisely what the FTC is looking at now. So we didn't have mobile before. We didn't have the sophisticated kinds of behavioral profiling that currently take place online. And COPPA is a flexible enough law that it can be applied to these new practices so that companies cannot follow your child around. Now, you know, they don't even need to know your name or your child's name in order to know who you are and how to reach you. So the law can be extended to cover those kinds of practices. And we're working to ensure that it is. I still think we need to think about our adolescents. What can we do to protect them? How can we create a set of fair marketing practices? Why should they be fair game for all kinds of egregious practices that don't take their needs into account? And that's another area that I'm working on along with other advocates.
Ultimately, the role of the parent here has to be to help to teach their children to have a healthy skepticism of messages.
We all have a role to play. There's no question.
Yeah.
Parents do. It's going to be increasingly challenging for them. But I think they are learning more about it. And educators, as the caller from a few minutes ago talked about, educators need to be informed about all of this so that they can play a role in arming young people in ways that they can navigate this new world effectively.
Yeah, I mean the technology is wonderful. It's marvelous.
Oh, it is.
And I'm trying to imagine a world without the internet. What did we do before cell phones? I mean, all of these things. And in fact, next hour we're going to be talking about how all the technology we have affects our lives and what we need to understand about it. But this is a wonderful world we've created. But there are some bad things out there that we all need to be aware of.
That's right. And I would like to end by saying that I believe that this new digital media culture is a terrific, terrific development for our young people. And we're seeing digital media used for civic engagement and political involvement in ways we never saw before. I think it's fabulous. We just need some rules of the game to make sure that marketers and others operate fairly and that we don't put young people at risk.
Give that website again that you gave earlier.
Digitalads.org.
Digitalads.org. Thank you, Professor Montgomery, for an interesting hour. I appreciate
your time.
You're
certainly welcome.
Morning.
I very much enjoyed it.
My guest has been Catherine Montgomery, communication professor at American University, co-author of the report Alcohol Marketing in the Digital Age. Chrissy Pease produced this hour. Erica Janik handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Stick around. More to come next hour. And remember, we're carrying President Obama's speech and press conference at 11:40 this morning. Stay tuned for that. It's the Ideas Network of WPR.